listening to TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Now, the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. And today is another TBR Radio Show, which is the Barnes Review. I urge you to go to barnesreview.com and you can find details there of how to subscribe to an e-newsletter, which will give you updates on stories, etc. And it's very easy to unsubscribe if you find that you don't like that, so you're not going to be bombarded by their emails. There's simple instructions at the bottom, so I urge you to give it a try. If you like what you hear and you want to subscribe, then you click the subscriptions button. That opens up another page. You scroll down, there's an image on your left. You click on that and that takes you to the main page that gives you options of how you subscribe depending on the length of time you want to subscribe and where you are based in the world. Now, joining me today is a guest that I've interviewed before on my show, and this was show number 31. And if you go to my website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, and you hover your mouse over the radio show page, or the radio show link on the navigation bar, a drop down will appear. You click the top one, which is the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show, and when that opens up, you scroll down to number 31, which was March the 14th, 2016, and it was Victor Thorne who we have joining us today. So, Victor, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Andrew?
Yeah, it's great to have you back on, and you know, things are going well with the show, and with the project now with the Barnes Review, it's been very exciting for me because I've actually learned things that I didn't know by having a copy of the current issue and literally going through it and preparing to interview different people on different articles, the contributors and what have you. And the show that I referred to that people can go to of the first show that you and I did, it's actually your bio, so it's quite an interesting show for people that have followed your work. But what we're going to start talking about today is you've got one article, and we discussed this before the show, so we're going to go through this first, and then in light of Hillary Clinton's recent nomination, we knew it was going to happen, but it's now been confirmed. We're going to go through some of the material you've got on the Clintons, because I know that you've written on them extensively, and you know, you have some of the go-to books about them and their crimes. So I've got the current issue here, just to let everyone know. This is the May-June 2016 issue. And on page 63, you've done an article entitled Beware Brokered Conventions. Now, I'm going to read a couple of minutes from the start of the article, just to set it up, to bring you in to expand on it and go through it in a greater depth. So, as I say, beware brokered conventions. If history teaches us any lessons, it's that all Americans should be extremely wary of a brokered Republican convention in Cleveland this upcoming July. In fact, it's deja vu to 1952, as you will see in this article by Victor Thorne. More than half a century ago, a similar situation eerily mirrored our circumstances today. As you'll see in this article, if we substitute the characters, we find the populist candidate, Donald Trump, continuous backstabbing by establishment insiders, Karl Rove, the re-emergence of a failed candidate, Mitt Romney, plus delegate rigging in the states of Louisiana and Texas. More importantly, the hidden hand of power-hungry elitists, which includes the Bush family then, as is still true today, is still desperately trying to call the shots. What transpired behind the scenes in smoke-filled rooms at the 1952 Republican National Convention should serve as a cautionary tale to each of us today. 64 years ago, the GOP underwent its last brokered convention, and the conspiracy that ensued shaped American policy domestically and abroad for decades into the future. Some may say even into the year 2016. Entering the July 1952 convention in Chicago, Senator Robert Taft of Ohio had amassed 2.8 million Republican votes in a dozen primaries, compared to 2 million collected by World War II military hero Dwight Eisenhower. However, at that time, approximately 75% of states held neither primaries nor caucuses. Instead, delegates were selected by influential representatives and state governors. Obviously, this flawed framework led to the possibility of rampant manipulation and corruption. Taft, the son of America's 27th president, William Howard Taft, also held as his campaign manager former United States Republican Howard Buffett, father of financier extraordinaire Warren Buffett. So, although a player by any definition of the word, Taft ran on an America First platform. He espoused a non-interventionist foreign policy, doubted NATO's effectiveness, and sought to warm relations with the Russians. At home, Taft remarked, "Every Republican candidate for president since 1936 has been nominated by Chase National Bank." These stances made Taft a favourite among the Republican Party's conservative wing, who called him Mr. Republican. Eisenhower, Taft's most internationalist opponent, possessed no political experience whatsoever. On the other hand, Ike found good fortune in being backed by some of the most powerful establishment bigwigs of that era, including New York Governor Thomas Dewey, who'd lost two previous presidential elections in 1944 and 1948, and California Governor Earl Warren. Thus, quickly after Eisenhower was pushed into the race, bought and paid for mouthpieces in the media peddled the mantra that Taft couldn't win in the general election because of his populist views. Now, I'm sorry for that long introduction there, Victor, but I just wanted to set the stage for everybody. And essentially, you're relating that to Donald Trump today. And from myself, looking from overseas over in England, it would seem that, you know, he's got the nomination. But from what you've said there, that's not necessarily the case.
Right. Well, when I wrote this article, it still hadn't been finalized that Donald Trump would be the presumptive Republican nominee. So what I was doing was showing how there were so many similarities between what Trump was going through and what had happened numerous times in the past. And the last brokered convention was, you know, 60 or 70 years ago. But, yeah, this showed that there's a lot of shenanigans going on all the time behind the scenes, and that, you know, even though Trump is still there now, you know, he's over the amount of delegates he needs, it still is left to be seen. I mean, there's still people like Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush and these folks behind the scenes that are running these, you know, Never Trump campaigns and so forth. And if I was Donald Trump, I still wouldn't bank on being the nominee until after the Republican National Convention in Cleveland next month. So, you know, there's always going to be that unknown variable, and the way many of the GOP elites still are suspicious of Trump or outright hate Trump, you know, if I was him, I would still be very careful as he proceeds into Cleveland next month.
Yes, I mean, I was just thinking about what you said there as well, and it's not just, okay, it looks like he's got it all on paper, but we know who controls the media, we know who controls the government, and on a physical level, he could be assassinated at any time. And the thing about Trump is he is a unique individual of himself. He's not really got someone behind him who everyone knows like Trump. Trump is Trump, and if suddenly you take him away, you will just get another Republican talking head, like Ted Cruz or something, who was the closest to him, to take his place. And of course, none of the people that ran against him are anything like him. So there's that thing to worry about, because if they just plain take him out, and they don't have to take him out in a Kennedy-style thing, they could take him out with a variety of weapons that they've got that make him look like he had a heart attack or what have you. So there's that to think about. And there's also the media control. We know that he's had a rather how can I put it, a varied life with the women, shall we say, and they only need to suddenly pull out, you know, scandal regarding that, or they could push the underage angle, or they've already tried to talk about women who allege she abused them and things, something bad enough that could essentially get the Republicans to say, look, we can't take the risk with this guy. So these are two scenarios I could think of that could even topple him from getting a nomination when it looks like it's all done on paper.
Right. Well, to address all of what you just said, the big New York Times article, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, front page, and it went on for thousands of words, and supposedly it detailed Donald Trump's rocky road with women. And what it ends up happening was many of the women cited in this article came out a day or two later and said they completely misconstrued, they took out of context what I said during the interview. They assured me that this wouldn't be a hit piece against Donald Trump. What they said, they chopped up or so forth, and they came out and said, we like Donald Trump. Donald Trump treated us with respect. He was never abusive to us or anything like that. And so I didn't read the entire article because I saw what nonsense it was, but I read some of it, and it was, you know, it had things like, well, it beauty pageants, which Donald Trump hosted, it said Donald Trump was commenting about how beautiful these women were. And Donald Trump, she had said that, you know, could I take a photo of you? And you have a very beautiful body. I was like, this is what we want from a candidate, isn't it? I mean, compared to Barack Obama and all of the rumors about him, I would like to have a heterosexual back in the White House again. And someone that says, hey, you have a nice body, when he sees a woman, especially at a beauty pageant. I mean, what else are you supposed to say? So it was really shoddy journalism on the New York Times part, and I think it really blew up in their faces afterward because it was revealed really what an agenda they had going after Trump. And I know we're going to talk about the Clintons a little bit later, but since we're on the subject of women, it's very peculiar that Donald Trump, the worst he did was make comments about how nice a woman looked in her bathing suit. And then we have Bill Clinton, who there are numerous women on record still speaking today that said Bill Clinton raped them. He used force to rape them. Juanita Broderick says Bill Clinton nearly bit her lips off as he was holding her down while he was raping her. Why isn't the New York Times examining these stories and putting Juanita Broderick and Kathleen Willey and all of the others on their front page article and showing what a genuine monster Bill Clinton is, and his wife, who was the enabler and the hitman, who her and her cronies, her operative, went out and tracked these women down and abused them and threatened them and left little reminders. They would leave shotgun shells on the seat of their truck or smash their windshield or break into their apartments. So I hope that everybody listening to this realizes that what a scam job is being played on them by the media and what an unfair playing field is. I mean, a lot of people criticize Donald Trump and they say, oh, he's really thin-skinned and why doesn't he get over it? Well, when he's seeing these kind of hatchet jobs on him compared to potentially what really could be written about the Clintons, I can understand Trump to a certain degree of why he is so upset with the media, because the treatment being afforded to him as opposed to the Clintons isn't anywhere near the same.
Yes, and I mean, you know, on what you say on the media, we can again ask why they don't, when they criticize so-called evil Holocaust deniers, oh, they deny 6 million people died in the Holocaust. Well, why don't they put up the picture of the two plaques in Auschwitz, one that said 4 million Jews died here, and the one that replaced it that says 1.5 million Jews died here, and explain how 6 million minus 2.5 million equals 6 million. And on top of that, when they say about the crazy 9/11 skeptics and, you know, the Osama bin Laden didn't do it and all this sort of stuff, why don't they put on a picture of World Trade Center Building 7? Why don't they explain how the owner, Larry Silverstein, said that after such a major loss of life, we made the decision to pull it. And you can only pull a building if you've wired it up for months beforehand on a building of that size with explosives. They don't come pre-wired. But it's just, again, an example of how this mainstream media thinks that we're all idiots out there. None of us do any research. None of us do any reading. And we'll just believe what is printed. And sadly, Victor, I think the article that you referred to, most people will have believed it and they would not have read any of the follow-ups. And what you find as well is whenever a newspaper publishes a hit piece, even if they're sued, you know, the hit piece is on the first page and the retraction is like in a little column in the corner of page 7.
Oh, exactly, yeah. And that's a key point, especially when it's the New York Times, the so-called paper of record. you know, if the New York Times says it, it must be true. So this wasn't like, you know, some newspaper out in, you know, podunk nowhere. This was the New York Times that did this. And not only are these things, all the examples you mentioned about 9/11 and so forth, but there's another thing that really, when I look at it, and it's used so prevalently, and of, you know, all the articles I've written over the last 7 or 8 years for American Free Press, actually it's 9 years now that I think about it, but another one of the big conditioning devices, and this is vital to understand, is the use of polls and polling data. And in the 9 years that I've written for American Free Press, I don't think I've ever once cited a poll in any of my articles, precisely for the reason is that all they are is conditioning devices. And what it's being used to do is to sway or push or nudge, as Cass Sunstein says, to nudge people in a certain desired direction. So, I mean, for all of these years, you know, and you see polling data every day, you see new polls everywhere. And all the people I ask, have you ever been polled? And very rarely does anyone ever say yes that they have been. I mean, I've been polled maybe once or twice in my life. So where's all this information coming from? And from my perspective, it's all being pulled out of thin air, and that they're using it to push the populace in a certain direction. So, and not only that, then you see conflicting polling data. One of them says Hillary Clinton is over Trump by 10 points. The other one says Trump is leading Hillary by 3 points. And none of them even correlate with one another. So, I mean, I think that's really an important point that we should stress, is that these polls, when I see them, you know, on TV or whatever, I just click the channel. Or if I read them in an article, I just gloss over, because I'm not going to allow myself to be conditioned, not that they could anyway, but I'm afraid that so many people see these poll after poll after poll, and they're like, you know, it's almost like a sheeple effect, that, well, if everybody else is following along, I guess I better too. You know, if they do an experiment and they hold up a blue card, but they tell 10 people in a row to say that it's red, well, the next person doesn't want to seem like they're an anomaly, so they say that the card is red, even though they know that it's blue. They start trusting everybody else instead of their own instincts and their own senses. So, you know, this is a point that is something I've noticed for decades, really, and that anybody that allows themselves to be influenced by it, I hope they know that this is exactly the desired effect, that those putting out these polls want to influence them to say this is really the candidate that you should be voting for.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting you raise the subject of polls, because that's always been something that interested me. I mean, you know, in America, you've got nigh on 300 million people, and when they take these polls, you're lucky if they've measured the opinions of a few thousand. So how can that be a respected scientific study? You know, if you were going to do it in any sort of scientific experiment, they'd say, well, that's not a large enough representation, surely. And so they're clearly doing it for something, and I think that your interpretation of it is very good, because unfortunately people are so scared of appearing to step outside the norm, and that really just goes to kind of show how the manipulation takes place on so many levels. So it's not just media stories. This is another way of saying, look, you know, this is how it's gonna pan out. So which side do you want to be on?
Well, and on top of that, even if these polls were legitimate, which I have high doubts about, but then it comes down to how the question is framed or how the question is asked. So, I mean, I can ask you a question and then ask it to you in an entirely different way and get completely different answers, depending on what I wanted to elicit from you. So that's another aspect of it, is you have to bring in the bias of the pollster that's asking the questions. And then on top of that, you have to find out who the audience is. I mean, if I went to, let's say, San Francisco, California, and did a poll, it would be much, much different than the poll taken in Nebraska or in the middle of the heartland. So if a polling operation once a more liberal outcome, of course they're going to find an audience that relates to that. And so there's so many aspects of it that are flawed or just downright corrupt that really all of us need to just move away from polling data and don't allow ourselves to be I guess influenced by it, because all it is it's smacking us in the face and telling us you're not bright enough to think for yourself, so here, this is the way you should go. And it's one of those things that maybe not the biggest issue on the planet Earth today, but it's one that if you see how much polling information is out there on any given day, you know there has to be a motive behind it.
Yes, I mean, we've covered the scandal side of things then with Trump. It looks like they've brought out, you know, they've already been working on that, and that doesn't seem to have worked. So now we look at the assassination side. I believe that he is, or he has been wearing a bulletproof vest, so he's clearly worried about that. And we saw the recent, was it in San Jose or San Diego? Or it was where you had all these rioters at his at one of his conventions, and they were just allowed to run roughshod over there. Is that correct?
Well, there was, this was a few weeks ago, maybe now even a month ago, but when he spoke at a Republican convention in California, one of the things that happened after Ronald Reagan was nearly assassinated in 1981 was that Secret Service says that a candidate or a president can never allowed to be seen arriving to or exiting from a venue wide out in the open. In other words, if Donald Trump was going to speak at your house today, what they would do is they would put a canopy up, or they would put barricades up or a facade up, so when he exited from his vehicle, nobody would see him entering the venue at hand. And that's how the sharpshooters in 1981 actually hit Reagan. It wasn't John Hinckley. He was simply a patsy. But they were up on top of, they called it the grassy roof, and there were some sharpshooters up above where he was exiting and going into his limo, and that's where they shot him. So one of the big rules they made was that a candidate can't be seen out in the open like that. Well, at this convention in California, there were so many protesters blocking the front of this arena that Trump, they had helicopters flying above, and they showed him he had to, like, jump over a barricade, and he had to go through some grass and walk down a sidewalk and move around the back of the building, all wide out in the open. And Donald Trump even said his wife called him and said, I'm watching on TV now from this helicopter video, and I can see you going into the venue. So this broke every protocol there was of allowing a candidate out in the open. So if they're doing that, and you know, the big question would be is why wouldn't security at this arena move all of the protesters, or you know, a lot of times they're beyond just mere protesters, they're agitators and provocateurs, but move them out of the way so that the candidates can get into the building safely. So what they did was they genuinely jeopardized Trump's safety that day. And you're correct that not only has he been wearing a vest for months and months, but Trump also has his own personal security detail, because I don't think it's too surprising that in his mind he would say, why should I trust the Secret Service? Look what the Secret Service did when they stood down with John F. Kennedy in Dallas. So not only does he have official government Secret Service personnel, but also his own, which is a very good idea.
Yes, I mean, you know, a bulletproof vest or not, if people can get in close enough like that and you get a headshot, you don't wear a bulletproof mask, you know, then that's it. Good night, Vienna.
Yeah, exactly.
So what I'll do is I've highlighted the last part of the article because you're going far in great detail, and my end part is literally just the last paragraph. And I encourage people to get the issue because you go into far more detail on this brokered Republican convention going back, you know, some 50 years. At the end, you wrap up by saying, Thus, when Eisenhower bemoaned the existence of a nefarious military-industrial complex during his January the 17th, 1961 farewell address, it came as too little too late. The backroom deals made in 1952 at the Republican National Convention ensured that its existence would flourish under the eyes-closed-on-all-fronts Eisenhower administration. So essentially...
Yeah, that's...
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's... I mean, anybody that's studied conspiracy research in depth knows that the 1950s and moving into the 1960s was like the Wild West when it comes to the CIA. And not only were they, you know, performing coups in countries all around the world, but they also had MK Ultra. They're doing the mind control, the psychic driving, hypnotism, the drug research, and on and on. And for all of these things to occur, Dwight Eisenhower was the perfect president because, like Obama, he was out on the golf course all the time. He wasn't hands-on. He didn't seem occupied at all with trying to look at all of the things going on behind the veil. So the CIA and the many tentacles of the octopus were really running rampant back in those days, and they needed a president like Dwight Eisenhower, who, you know, this was the black and white 50s, and he was an older gentleman. He really didn't have any political experience whatsoever. He was a military general. So he was a figurehead. They plopped him in the Oval Office, and then the rogue government really ran all of the operations. So if you would have had somebody else that was more patriotic, more nationalistic, more suspicious even, and, you know, like John Kennedy ultimately said he was going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind, well, it's impossible to think Dwight Eisenhower would even conjure these thoughts. And it was only after his presidency ended and he gave his farewell address that he gave this warning that he, you know, must have had some suspicion of what was going on. And, you know, he was taken out to do some of the MJ-12, you know, with the extraterrestrials. So he had an idea what was going on, but he did issue this warning to the American people to be wary of this military-industrial complex. And regrettably, not enough of us have paid attention, and this structure has remained intact to this day. And when you have these brokered conventions, what it's doing is saying that the will of the voters doesn't matter, and we're going to put in the candidate that we want to be in there. I don't know how much different it is today, even with our primaries, that there's so many factors, like with the Democrats and these superdelegates. Basically, what the Democrats have said, I mean, some of the representatives have come right out and stated directly is we can't trust the voters. So, you know, Hillary Clinton... of all the superdelegates, she's received over 90% of them compared to Bernie Sanders. It's like 500 and some for Hillary to 40. I mean, Hillary doesn't even have the nomination now simply on delegates that she received being the voting process. It's only with the superdelegates that she's pushed over the top. So is it really all that much different today? They just use different procedures and different techniques.
Yes, and I mean, as soon as it looks like, you know, Donald Trump on paper has got the nomination, suddenly people like Addison, these elite Jews, start supporting him because it's like, okay, we're stuck with him. Now we've got to somehow, you know, buy into what he is so that we can have some sort of control. You know, they don't, and this is the way that they always seem to work, these elites, because they like to control both sides, and they wouldn't throw all their eggs into one basket for Hillary, because then if he gets in, they've got no leverage with him. And so you see already they're jumping head over heels to try and get involved with Trump so they can have some sort of influence on the message he's going to provide.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I visited with a woman yesterday, very astute in politics, and she's maybe a decade and a half older than me. She's been studying politics since her 20s, and we see each other 3 or 4 times a year and talk about current events. And I was explaining, and she's not real happy with either candidate, But I explained to her that in my younger days, I was more idealistic, and generally I would vote third party, that I didn't like the Republican candidate, I didn't like the Democrat, so I would vote for a third. What I came to realize, much to my chagrin, was that, and this is a fact, that 99% of people vote in the presidential election for either the Republican or the Democrat. The independents always get 1% of the vote or less. So being that I'm not as idealistic as I used to be, it boils down to right now in this 2016 election is, do you want you, meaning the listeners, do they want Hillary Clinton to be the president? Do they want 4 or 8 more years of this disaster, this train wreck of Barack Obama? A lot of people don't like Donald Trump. What it comes down to is one of these two, if they both secure the nomination like it looks like they're going to, either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton are going to be the president. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. So, you know, voting for someone other than Trump or voting third party or whatever is, what you're doing is if you don't want Hillary in office, you have to vote for Trump, because not voting for him means that you're de facto voting for Hillary. And, you know, people might not agree with my rationale, but that's the way I see it, is one of these two are going to be president. And I can't fathom America on the course of Barack Obama, this socialism, Marxist, anti-Americanism. I can't imagine 4 or 8 more years of it. And Hillary has come out and said, point blank, I'm going to continue Obama's policies. She's not making any bones about it. So to me, it's very black and white, that if the people in this country want a change away from this really what I think is it's a traitorous, treasonous president that we have that so despises America and so despises white people that they have to vote for Trump, because if not, Hillary's going to continue this multiculturalism, this agenda of the radical feminists, the homosexuals, the transgenders, the illegal aliens, and on and on and on. I mean, she said she's going to bring even more refugees in from Muslim countries than Obama is even bringing in. So on every single level, it's a disaster. So, you know, I to me, even if somebody isn't all that enthralled with Donald Trump, they have to ultimately ask themselves the question, do we want more of the same? And to me, it's unfathomable.
Yes, I mean, I agree. From my perspective, I've been sent different things. And, you know, of course, the links with Trump, his daughter married to a Jew. And I just got sent an image of him with these rabbis and stuff. And these things are going to come up because he is going to meet different groups and what have you. But the issue is you literally have got two choices. It's like going to a restaurant and there are two things on the menu. You pretty much should know straight away what you're going to have. There is no third, fourth, or fifth choice. So you have to vote with your head, not your heart. And you literally have to say, right, you know, I'm going to starve unless I eat one of these two dishes. So which one is the less unpleasant one to eat? And I can't imagine anything worse than Hillary Clinton at all. As you say, the focus that we've had on transgenderism and homosexual marriage and all that, when we know that Hillary Clinton is a lesbian anyway, and we know that Barack Obama, I'm quite satisfied anyway that he is married to a transsexual by various different videos and images that I've seen of Michelle Obama. And, you know, do you honestly think that any of that is going to be reversed? No, it's going to get worse. And in the same way as you had the forced busings in America with the schools and the desegregation, you're going to have enforced bathrooms. You're going to have enforced transgenderism, enforced homosexuality. You're going to have, I wouldn't be surprised if they would shake up virtually every institution and says, you know, at least a quarter of your employees have to be homosexual, or at least a quarter of your teachers in school have to be homosexual. People might think that that's a bizarre statement. But if you go back to the election 4 years ago, did anyone think that they were going to get gay marriage? Did anyone then think they were going to get all this transgenderism? No, if I was talking about that back then, Victor, they'd have said I was mad then. But what they've got to look at is, you know, what is the next stage? How more depraved can it go? And I can only see an increase in what we've had, or the next stage is going to be pedophilia, and they're going to be lowering that age. They've already had these pressure groups from there trying to get it recognised as some sort of sexual attraction to, I forget the words that they use, but try to make it a scientific medical condition that they can get away with.
Well, no, they don't even, actually, they don't even need that. The way they're doing it is through all of this, quote-unquote, identity and fluid gender. I had a great wide, you know, periodic conversations with Pete Papahericles, who sometimes writes for TBR. And if gender is fluid, and in essence, any of our ideas are fluid, nothing is set, nothing is permanent or fixed, then what if somebody says that they identify, and that's all, that if you talk to these people that support the fluid identity or the transgenders, all that matters is what they identify as, okay? That's all that matters. So if somebody identifies as a dog, say it's a 40-year-old man who identifies as a dog, and he wants to start having sex with his German Shepherd. Now, If the fluids are consistent, they would say, well, all that matters is that he identifies as a dog. So he can marry his German Shepherd, have sex with it, and now all of a sudden, bestiality is okay. Well, what if somebody, what if a mother, let's say a 38-year-old mother, no longer identifies as the mother of her 18-year-old son? She doesn't identify as the mother. And she starts having sex with her 18-year-old son. When the cops come and find it, you know, they try to arrest her, and she's like, oh, no, wait, I don't identify as the mother. That's all that matters is what I identify in my mind. So now we have incest being okay. Now the same thing is, what if a 60-year-old pervert identifies as being 6 years old, and he's playing around, he's playing doctor with a 6-year-old girl? Well, all that matters is what you identify as. So this is an extremely dangerous, slippery slope. And I've mentioned this to a lot of liberals, and they're completely confounded. Like, their brain, they can't wrap around it, because they want to stay true to this whole thing as all that matters is that what you identify as. But when the realities of this situation become apparent, they can't comprehend the next step and the next step and the next step. Now, of course, the people plotting behind the scenes have all of this mapped out. And you're right, Andrew, is that will there be forced homosexual hiring in the workplace and on and on? And another thing that, as you said, it's guaranteed true that Hillary Clinton is a lesbian or at least bisexual. And Barack Obama, if you take the accounts of Larry Sinclair and numerous other people from the Chicago underworld, that they say Barack Obama is homosexual or bisexual also. Well, we're told now in the media and all of these liberals that they're like, you should take pride in your sexual identity, and if you're a homosexual, this is something to be celebrated. It's not something to be ashamed of. We really need to have tolerance for everyone and come together. Well, if this is true, then why is Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama so ashamed of their sexual preferences that there's not a chance in a million that they come out and reveal it to the public? The same with Michelle Obama. So we're told on the one hand, oh, it's a great lifestyle. Being a homo or a lesbian is so, it's so wonderful. But Barack Obama is utterly, utterly disgraced and ashamed of his own being, his own preferences. The same with Hillary. Why doesn't Hillary come out? I hear all the time during the debates talking about, oh, she's a great proponent of the lesbians and homosexuals. Why doesn't she just admit that she's a lesbian? There's so much information on the books that verifies it. If this is the greatest thing in the world, why not come out and admit it?
Yes, and I mean, exactly. It's the sort of thing that what I saw her say when she's got this nomination, there were two things. Firstly, there was a tweet that she did, and it was her shaking hands of some little, you know, looked like 2 or 3 year old black girl. You know, anyone can be president. It was that sort of thing. It was this, and then that was there. So that was getting all your, I mean, you know, she doesn't need to struggle to get this minority vote. That's going to come anyway for the Democrats. But then the other thing was, the first thing she said, this is a victory for women. So it's basically saying, right, all the women are going to vote for her because she's a woman and they've never had a woman president. So all the women are going to vote for her, and then she'll get all the minority votes as well. And that should be enough to carry her over.
Yeah, well, and as I've written numerous times in American Free Press articles, in my book, Crowning Clinton, and also the Clinton Trilogy, all available from AFP and TBR, is that there's not a woman in America that's more of a misogynist, that hates women more than Hillary Clinton does. And the reason why is that she has had to do so many despicable things for decade after decade, covering up for her serial sexual predator husband, that it's put her in a position that she hates these women that she has to attack. Because, I mean, even though her and Bill have an arranged marriage, there's no intimacy whatsoever between these two, she still, you know, there were many stories when he was governor of Arkansas and they would go to a dinner party and Bill would blatantly flirt and hit on women and even take women into the bathroom and have sex with them right in front of Hillary. Not only is this humiliating, is this disgraceful, but you have to watch your own husband hitting on women, having sex with them, and I don't care who it is, this ends up becoming like a cancer inside of a woman. Even Hillary Clinton, who's, you know, almost like alien in her lack of emotionalism, but you know, that it ends up year after year, it eats away at her, and she hates women. So even though this is this huge paradox we have, that sexually she prefers women because she hates men, but she still hates women because of what the position she's been put in with her husband to go out and attack these women. So we have this extremely complex situation, and there's a book coming out in the next 2 or 3 weeks written by one of the Secret Service agents that stood outside the Oval Office for 8 years when Bill Clinton was the president. And he finally said, he says, I can't stand by and not say anything. He says, we can't put America through 8 more years of this, what I witnessed during the Clinton tenure in the White House. And even though just, you know, small passages have been released from this book, he recounts how Bill Clinton walks out one day after this very loud fight, smashing glass. And what happened was that Hillary launched a vase at Bill, hit him right in the eye. Everybody can remember the pictures of Bill Clinton. He comes out with this big shiner. So the Secret Service agent, he goes in, he cleans up the mess. Everybody has to clean up the mess for the Clintons. And then he's talking to Bill Clinton's secretary afterwards and says, what happened in there? He has a black eye. He actually referred to it as put a stake over the black eye. That's how bad it was. And the secretary said, oh, well, you know, he has allergies. The black eye's from his allergies. And he said, oh, only allergies in one eye, huh? So this book is going to be a blockbuster, I believe. And, you know, unlike mine, you know, like AFP books and TBR, because we're much more dangerous entities, the mainstream media won't review these books or carry these books. But this one here comes from a major publishing house. And it's, I guess the Clinton camp is already extremely terrified because they can't dismiss the Secret Service agent who had an exemplary career. He was in the military. He's not like some drug addict living under a bridge or whatever. It's going to be real hard to do to him what they did to like Paula Jones or Jennifer Flowers. So this is going to rock the Clinton world even more. But What I'm trying to say is everyone again has to ask, do we want 8 more years of the Clintons in Washington, D.C. running our country? And anyone that's read my Clinton trilogy just realizes that every single day it's a disaster waiting to happen. It's lies, scandal, violence between these two, cover-ups and sneaking around, and the murders of people like Vince Foster and 100 others. It's to me, it's incomprehensible that anybody, I mean anybody, of the 320 million people in America, that even one single person would vote for Hillary Clinton. But then again, I said the same thing in 2008 and 2012. I said it's incomprehensible that even one person in America would vote for Barack Obama. And, you know, 7 years later now, we see what this anti-American president did. So, again, please think before you go into these voting stations, because it's vitally important to our future. And, you know, Obama's and Clinton's, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yes, and I just want to take us back, Victor, because you made those excellent observations about this so-called fluid sexuality. So if a mother with her 18-year-old son says, well, I don't identify as his mother anymore, then that's enough, and she can do what she wants. Because, of course, that's actually already out there. There's a condition they've named. It's not called incest anymore. It's called genetic sexual attraction. So they've already lined up the name they give to it. Like, if you go back and you take the word gay, it used to be happy and gay, and now it means, you know, it's sodomy and what have you. They try to give it a cleaner, nicer word. Not that it's a clean, nicer word. What they're doing with this is they're making it a scientific phrase rather than just plain old incest. But one thing that struck me is I've seen stories in mainstream media, like the Daily Mail in the UK, and children as young as 3, between the ages of 3 and 5, are being admitted to gender reassignment clinics, okay? Now, you'll be aware of those stories, but let's take it all the way up to, you know, we know that children, 6, 7, 8-year-olds, are being allowed to dress, boys dress as girls, girls dress as boys, etc. Now, if I look up, I just typed into Google the age for legal responsibility, because I thought it was the age of 10 in the UK, and that is correct. And this is what it says. This is from the government website. The age of criminal responsibility in England and Wales is 10 years old. This means that children under 10 can't be arrested or charged with a crime. So they haven't got any responsibility for knowing what's right and wrong, in other words, but they are allowed to choose what sex they want to be from the age of 3. Your comments?
I guess all I can comment is by laughing at the absurdity of it. It's beyond comprehension. And again, this is the wave of what these Frankfurt School liberal Marxists, socialists, communists, whatever label you want to put on them, is that they want to so confound the natural order, whether it's nationalism or gender or any of the other, or, you know, identity, whatever it is, that they so want to screw everything up that we're coming and going and not, where it's like being on a roller coaster and doing whirly whirl. You don't know what's happening anymore. And it's no accident that this is coming from the top. I mean, this whole transgender bathroom issue in North Carolina, that Obama's Department of Justice is the one leveling the threats, saying that if you don't adhere to our policies, in other words, let any pervert in any bathroom anywhere they want, then what we're going to do is start withholding federal funds. And they do it also with education and on and on and on. So, yeah, I mean, all I can do, it's a nervous laughter, Andrew, is that, you know, when someone's so uncomfortable that they nervously laugh, it's a psychological response. But on the other hand, it's very dire, because not only is Obama 100% behind this agenda, so is Hillary, both of them, because they lead alternative lifestyles. And these are their people. These are the people they identify with. They don't identify with people that love America or want to protect our borders or people in the heartland or in rural America. They identify with sodomites and lesbians and rapists and freaks and perverts. And this is, it's beyond what a lot of, you know, this woman I mentioned, I was talking to her yesterday, she's in her late 60s, and she's almost unable to even comprehend it because, you know, she grew up in the 50s and so forth, and she's looking at the world today and saying, what the hell is happening? What is this? And we're going to have more of it with Hillary Clinton, so it's really time to put a stop to it.
Yes, I mean, we've got about 7 minutes left, so is there anything else that you would like to get into, or would you like me to raise another topic on behalf of the Clintons? Because really, actually, give people the names of each of your trilogy of books and whether they go to TBR, whether they can get them there, or if there's any other sites that you operate where people can go.
Yeah, well, these books are still selling really, really well. The trilogy, it's Hillary and Bill, the sex volume, Hillary and Bill, the drugs volume, and Hillary and Bill, the murder volume. Michael Collins Piper, when he was alive, said that, you know, without a doubt, these are the definitive books on the Clintons. This is the gold standard of the Clintons. It's what Roger Stone used as one of his primary source materials for his latest book that came out late last year called The Clintons' War on Women. And then right at the beginning of the year, American Free Press published Crowning Clinton, and I think the subtitle was something like Why Hillary Shouldn't Be Allowed Back into the White House. So all of these books are available, I believe, at TBR and American Free Press. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of discussion from now until the election in November. And a lot of times liberals will bring up points that, you know, if you're not a real source on the Clintons, it's hard to address the way they spin things. So these books are vitally important simply for the fact that we need to have the arguments that we can throw back at the liberals and the Marxists and say, wait, no. As a matter of fact, this isn't true what you just said. Well, you know, Hillary Clinton loves women. She's a champion. Well, as a matter of fact, no, Hillary Clinton hates women, and she attacks women, and she does everything in her power to destroy women. Well, at least those that stand in her way of reaching the next level, the next political level. So I think it's vitally important that that these books are still available, and I'm very thankful to American Free Press and TBR. And the other vital point is that unlike a mainstream publishing house that will, you know, dance on eggshells and so forth, that these books are totally uncensored. In other words, what I wrote is in these books. We don't have an editor in New York City that's saying, oh, well, I don't know, this might be a little bit politically incorrect if we say this. We better take it out. These books are published the way they were written, and they don't pull any punches. So if you want the real deal, this is where to go to find them.
Excellent. And you were talking earlier about in the 1950s we had these Manchurian candidates, things like that. With Bill Clinton, for example, there was this rumor that he was it Winthrop Rockefeller's son, and then also with Hillary Clinton there's a rumor that she's part Jewish, that her grandmother spoke Yiddish. In your research, are either of these claims true?
Well, in Hillary and Bill, the sex volume, I address the identity of Bill's father, and even though I can't 100% with certainty identify who the father was because these records don't exist, that the story about who Bill's quote-unquote father was, and he died in an automobile accident before he was born, and on, that there's not a kid that was born in Hope, Arkansas, to this floozy of a mother that was a gambling addict and drank hard and had a string of abusive husbands. There's not a chance in hell, none, zero, that this kid is going to become president of the United States unless he has the genetic bloodline. And if you also consider on top of that all of the trouble Bill got into in his early college days, getting kicked out of Oxford, I believe. And, I mean, just his entire life, sexual scandal and financial scandals and political scandals, that there's no chance he would become president unless the very highest powers on this planet were behind him, which explains Bill Clinton. And, you know, Hillary Clinton's already, well, when it was convenient to her, came out and admitted that on her grandmother's side she had Jewish blood. So very convenient when Hillary needs, you know, needs the tribe, then she taps into them and says, "Oh, of course, I'm one of them." So it's just astounding, Andrew, what these people have gotten away with for 40 plus years, and even today with the email scandal and Benghazi, yeah, and on and on, all of the scandals I chronicle in Crowning Clinton, that they're still getting away with it. Bill's trips to Pedophile Island with this Jewish billionaire that was convicted and imprisoned for his practices. Why isn't, you know, the media is asking about this Mexican judge that's going to see the Trump University case. Why don't they ask Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton about Jeffrey Epstein and Pedophile Island and the two dozen trips that Bill took there? He even ditched his Secret Service so that there were no witnesses to what he did on the airplane and what he did at this destination. They still get away with murder, quite literally.
Yes, I mean, also that Jeffrey Epstein case, that made it into the mainstream over here because Prince Andrew was strongly linked with that. And of course, yep. I mean, that quickly gets hushed up. These things get out, and I mean, they're all up to these sort of things. I think this pedophilia angle is something that, when the truth finally comes out about everything going on, I think you'll find literally that most of these people in senior positions are up to that sort of thing. Because in the past, you could say you could blackmail them for an affair or whatever, but now that everyone's so depraved, that's about the only thing that you could get them on, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's too much evidence out there for it to be denied. So, you know, we have two sick people in Bill and Hillary Clinton. They're sick. They're not just bad. They're sick people. They're depraved and they're psychopathic. And I mean, everything has to be done by every voter out there to prevent the perpetuation of the Clintons at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It just can't be allowed to happen.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me again today, Victor. It was a fantastic show. I want to thank everybody for listening as well, and I will be back with you all soon. Bye for now.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show on TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. In an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.